I really appreciated that story that you shared with us, Lene, in part because, so Lene shared this story about Mr. Rabbit, who wasn't paying attention, reading that newspaper. Everybody else around him was paying attention. And what I appreciate about that is, in a community of believers, there are times when we are not paying attention. And that is what we have our community of faith for, is to hold hope or to hold that faith and attention for us. And God knows I need that sometimes. And I appreciate having community that does that for me. That's not where I'm going with the sermon. What I had the song in my head that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It goes, "It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine." I can see people nodding along. This is by the band REM from 1987, but perpetually relevant. It's been on my head. It's been in my head on repeat for the last week or so. And aside from that very singable chorus, it's like this rapid fire confusion of pop culture and political references. And those are signifiers, I think, you know, in the writing of this song, that the world of 1987 is in decline and everything's going to heck in a handbasket. And that response to that chaos and cacophony is this sort of like kind of cynical singing as the ship goes down, kind of like, but we're all doing great. It's like a kind of a denial or cynicism on the part of, this is what I take away from it. So I think I see it as sort of like a send up of that very capitalist consumerist culture of the 80s. Surely Michael Stipe of REM did not literally think it was the end of the world. But I do think that's a band among others in subcultures who felt very much out of place in this world of the caught up in this cycle of consumerism and capitalism. And so that song was a protest to that, against that. And it still resonates. As I said, people are still singing that song these many years later. And it makes people who feel sort of dismal about the state of the world, makes us feel hopeful, makes us feel connected to other people who are sort of seeing things in the same way that we are. And so even though they may not have intended it as such, REM in 1987, we're very much singing in a tradition in line with Jesus' end of the world theology, with his end of the world sermon that Tony so eloquently read for us today. Mark's community in Jerusalem, so we have Jesus, who we read about, but Mark is the one who's writing this story. He's the writing, holding this story of Jesus together and putting it together for his disciples. Mark is putting it together for his community of people in Jerusalem in about like between like 65 and 70 AD. And during the time when Mark is writing this story about Jesus, his community was engaged in, his Jewish community was engaged in an uprising against Rome. So Jewish people have taken up arms against their occupiers, and Rome is violently striking back. So that is the context in which this is being written. People aren't sure exactly what's happening when. Perhaps the temple had already fallen, perhaps that was still coming, but Jerusalem was under siege or it was embattled. And either way, they absolutely would have felt like it was the end of the world. It would have really felt like everything that they knew was collapsing around them. Where are we supposed to turn to for hope, for understanding what is next? And Mark gave them the story of Jesus. So I've come to understand that what Mark is doing here with this particular part of the story about Jesus is a little bit more like fan fiction than historically accurate quotation. So that might sound sort of heretical, but Mark is taking some Jesus traditions, things that he knew Jesus had preached or spoken about. He's taken that Jesus tradition. He's taken some stuff from the Old Testament, from Daniel and Ezekiel especially, that were very sort of apocalyptic, responding to chaotic times kind of text, and he's put those together and given Jesus these words of ending and prediction and comfort to give to his Mark's people, to say, this is where Jesus is calling us, and this is how Jesus understands that. So particularly this, and present traditions too, I should say, the community of the Essenes during that present time, where when Jesus was alive, they were very much like, it's the end of the world, kind of a religious sect. So all of those traditions come together. In particular, there are some very particular things from sort of Daniel, for example, like that language of the human one or the son of man. Those are two ways of translating that. That's this idea of like this divine being returning with hope, returning to save. And so Mark is taking those and he's writing them into Jesus' mouth as teachings. And Jesus is answering his disciples' question about when is it going to happen? When is the world going to come to an end? How will we know that God is triumphing over evil? How will we know that this chaos, there's something after this chaos? It's the same questions that Mark's community has. And it's the same questions that people were asking in 1987. It's the same questions that we have now. Like, when will this be over? How will we know? How will we know, God, when you are going to set everything right? And that's all, like, great. They're answering those questions, and God's coming back, and it's all going to be good. But still, some of us want a little more than that. It's always the end of the world. It's the end of the world in Daniel's time. It's the end of the world in Jesus' time. It's the end of the world in Mark's time. It's the end of the world in 1987. It's the end of the world now. All of us are always experiencing the end of the world. But what do we do about it? What do we do? I'm sure that some of you have seen that bumper sticker that says, Jesus is coming back. Look busy. And it's kind of like funny. Like it's like facetious around like God wants us to be like doing something. But it's also kind of true. Like in all times and places, like Jesus has been teaching his disciples all the way along about what to do. And so now he tells this parable about a homeowner who leaves his faithful and trusted servants in charge of the home. And he says, so stay alert and stay watchful. That's the job he's giving them. Stay busy. You know, do your thing. And this story does a couple of things. I think one, it's like this huge foreshadowing of Jesus' experience in Gethsemane just a short time later, where the disciples don't do the thing that he says to do, which he like explicitly says, stay awake, stay alert. I'm asking you to do this. And they fail at that. I'm thinking, like, oh, I bet when Mark's people were like listening to that story, they're like, call back. Like Jesus just told them that they were supposed to do this, how important it was. But also it's a reminder to us, is to Jesus' disciples and to us, hey, I have been teaching you these many years, these many months about what it means to do the work of the kingdom, to do the work of God's household. So you should have a pretty good idea by now what that is. And one beloved passage to me, and I'm sure to many of you, is from Micah, to do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God. All of the ways that we take care of each other, that we lean into community, that we're peacemakers, that we heal, that we feed others, that we offer care. It's not just looking busy, it's doing those things that are kingdom building things, that are caring for each other and a community. The world is always ending and God is always near. God is at the door, I think is how that Jesus writes that. One of the things that our adult study class noticed about this text is that even though, particularly sort of the first read through, it's very chaotic and it's confusing and it's perplexing and it's disorienting. And there are many, many signs of hope along the way as we read through this sermon from Jesus. There's a lot of suffering, but the suffering that is read in some translations as just straight up suffering is also can be understood as birth pangs. And those of us who've given birth or are partners to those who have given birth know that at the end of birth, there's a child. There's a new life. And that's not in every case. And certainly in Jesus' time, sometimes that, births did not go well. But Jesus is saying, like, there's suffering and there's hope. Those two are held together. And as Lene mentioned, the fig tree, or like, even if we look outside, those branches are starting to bud. Yesterday, I trellised my raspberries, and when you first look at them, it looks like they're just a jumble of canes, but all of those little canes have little shoots that, by the end of summer, they'll have really delicious fruit on them. There's just, everything is on the verge of blooming and new growth, and I'm just staying alert for that first open bud. Jesus is making a prediction. He's making a couple of predictions, actually. He's talking about his, like, the cross. He's talking about his torture and his death, and that's going to be the end. That is going to feel like the end of the world to his disciples. Everything is going to come crashing down around them during that experience of his death. And, like, very literally, their generation will not pass away until that has happened. That world of Jesus and his disciples being community together is coming to an end. And their community is shattered. And then there will be new life. He's also talking about this possibility that within their literal generation and in the world of Mark, Jerusalem will fall and it will be the end of the world and there will be new life. And again, the world is always ending and there is always something new and God is always near. In every generation and even in our Anabaptist history, we don't often talk about the histories of the early Anabaptists who were the apocalyptic Anabaptists. But when I was in seminary, I studied a woman named Ursula Yost, who was well in her particular time in around 1535 or so. She was among a community of people for whom apocalyptic visions and predictions and literature were very helpful for a people who were experiencing chaos, experiencing what felt to them like it could be the end of the world. So I thought I'd read a snippet of what she wrote. Ursula had visions that then she published to her Anabaptist community. On the Friday before Palm Sunday in 1525, the glory of the Lord again approached me and unfolded. In it, I saw a pretty green tree which had many thousands of green branches. And then I saw that there came a great host of people who were all from the common folk. They drank the drops which ran off the branches, and they were all satisfied. And I saw they had their hands raised and their heads to the God, the Eternal Father, and to him gave the highest praise and thanks. It sounds a bit like a fairy tale, a bit nonsensical, but also images, very much images like the fig tree that Jesus was speaking of, or he talks about the human one coming and gathering in people from all nations and all places. Her words also sound sort of like Revelation that has, where you have see the tree of life and people from all nations gathered together. And what Ursula's visions did, and like there was that small community of apocalyptic Anabaptists during that time, is, they were experiencing real suffering at the hands of the state. And they were speaking, she was speaking to a people who were persecuted and alienated. And they were trying to figure out how to be faithful in that time. And I'll just read one last thing from Lois Barrett, who wrote about Ursula Yost. Ursula's visions helped readers cope with the crises by putting them in the context of God's ultimate plan for the present age. The crises of the period of her visions, 1524 to 1530, were unmistakable. The burden of the land ties on the peasants' war, the overturning of power of the Roman Catholic Church in many cities, the persecution of religious dissenters. Some of these crises, Ursula's vision put in the context of God's judgment and wrath over other cases, the vision called for patience and endurance until God could save the people. And they asserted that God was in control of history. The world is ending and God is near. The world is always ending and God is always near. Like for Daniel and for Jesus and for Mark and for REM and for us, the world is always ending and God is always near. May we continue to do the work as we are called to, as we await God's kingdom, and as we dwell even now in God's kingdom. God is always near. Amen.